Where we left off, but I'll remind you a little bit of what we had shown so far. So, remember, the big project was to compute the entanglement entropy for one set of coupled oscillators relative to another set. In other words, we had a collection of n coupled harmonic oscillators in their overall ground state. We divided them into two sets, set one and set two, and found the effective or reduced density matrix to describe the state of the first set, and we were engaged in computing the entropy of that reduced density matrix, which is known as the entanglement entropy between the two sets of oscillators. And we had found a general formula for the reduced density matrix, and we saw that it was of a Gaussian form. In other words, it looked like an exponential of some quadratic expression in the variables Q, or X, if you like, the position variables describing the set of harmonic oscillators, set one. And then we were trying to find the entropy of such a density matrix, and to do that we considered a special case where there were only two oscillators. Okay, so in this special case, I never know how to draw a harmonic oscillator, but some object on a spring and some spring connecting the two. Okay, so we have two coupled harmonic oscillators. Actually, in this case, I think we didn't put a spring connecting the two, but we just considered, just by pulling out of a hat, a particular state of the joint oscillators, which was, in fact, I didn't bother to derive it from any Hamiltonian to make this state. So, but I guess it could be viewed like this if you chose the Hamiltonian correctly. But I just wrote down the state itself. This is the analog of the ground state. So it's a pure state for the pair of harmonic oscillators. We're going to trace out the one oscillator and get, or we did trace out the one oscillator and get the reduced density matrix for the other one. And it was acting on the vacuum. So it's a so-called squeeze state, or what's the other word for it? Bogoliubov transform of the ordinary vacuum state. This is the A oscillator. I mean, this is the creation operator corresponding to the first oscillator, and this is the creation operator B star corresponding to the second oscillator. I guess I wrote it like this, using this notation, for that 0, 0, the overall unexcited state. Okay. And then we found, on the one hand, we found the entropy for that. We found that the entropy for row one, need something to weigh down a little bit more of this board. Okay, so we found that the entropy for row one, so this is oscillator one, this is oscillator two, we found that the entropy for the reduced density matrix row one, which was the trace with respect to the second oscillator of the overall density matrix, which is, of course, a pure state, and that was equal to minus log 1 minus gamma squared minus gamma squared over 1 minus gamma squared times the log of gamma squared. So we just derived that using known formulas for the entropy of a thermal state. This reduced state turns out to be a thermal state for the first oscillator, which we actually rederived, but anyway, it doesn't matter. That's the first thing, the main result. And the other one that we need to recall is we found, this is really the expression of a fact that what we've done here is a Bogoliubov transformation, that the state is, well, let me write it this way. that this that this state that we had started with, psi, is annihilated by this combination of creation and annihilation operators. So it's as if this were a new annihilation operator for some other vacuum, which is the, or it's as if this psi were the vacuum for this annihilation operator. And then by symmetry, this is equal, this is true. So all of that is what we had done last time. And now we want, so this is fine. We have a state, which I didn't write down explicitly. We know its entropy. But we want to compare it to the reduced density matrix that we found for the set of coupled harmonic oscillators. And we had found that in a position basis. So in order to make that comparison, we should re-express this density matrix, this rho 1, in the position basis for the first oscillator. Okay, so we want to do that. We have to, at least the way we're going to do it, as I keep saying, it all, I always feel that there's a more direct route, but this is the route that I know. So we will work out what is this ground state. This is actually almost just repeating step for step what we did for the coupled, the n-coupled oscillators, here just done for two. So we'll work out, the only difference is that in this case of two, we know the answer for the entropy, and we can use that then to get the answer for the entropy for the n-coupled oscillators. So we want to put this ground state in the position basis, and I'll, using standard notation, this is the sort of Dirac notation for the components of this state psi that we defined here. And this is the more traditional or older, just regarding psi as a function, I mean, to write psi as a function of x and y. And we also have the operator p hat, which in this representation, of course, is partial x, and q hat. Unfortunately, I have to apologize a little for this notation. So I'm calling the position coordinates x and y for the two oscillators, and I'm calling the corresponding momenta p hat and q hat. Okay. Of course, this q hat, that's actually a confusing notation because earlier I had, in itself it's fine, but earlier I had used q hat to mean the position operator. Now I just mean another momentum operator. So I hope it won't lead to too much confusion. And then just remembering, as we derived, or as you can find in almost any textbook, the relation between the p's and q's and the creation and annihilation operators, using the normalization that we have here, is this q minus I y hat by y. X hat, I just mean, of course, the operator of multiplying by x, and by y hat, I mean the operator of multiplying by y. That's all very familiar from ordinary sort of elementary quantum mechanics. Now we've gone through this all. So once we make the substitution, this so-called Schrödinger representation, then these two equations that characterize the ground state, or this, let's just call it the state that I've set up here, the squeeze state, the two equations that characterize the squeeze state, they become now partial differential equations for psi of x and y. And we can solve those. I'm not, since we did it essentially, did it before, there's no point in repeating all the details, but let me just tell you what the answer is. So to solve it, it's convenient to make a change of variables. So v is x plus gamma y, and v is y, the symmetric thing, y plus gamma x. If we do that, then it separates into the equations for two decoupled harmonic oscillators. The solution is then just a Gaussian for each state. So we find that psi psi is equal to some function of u, and by symmetry, the same function of v, then transform back to the x and y. Once we have that function, we can transform it back to the x and y variables. And the answer is the following. In other words, the solution of this pair of partial differential equations here is the following. Of Gaussian, of course, some unimportant normalization, and then it's minus 1 plus gamma squared over 1 minus gamma squared times x squared plus y squared over 2 minus 2 gamma over 1 minus gamma squared times xy is how it comes out. Okay. So that's psi of xy. Now, and as you can see, of course, it's a Gaussian because it's just like the ground state of, it's a squeezed state, but it's the ground state of some other Hamiltonian, which is linearly related to the original one. So it's, of course, going to take a Gaussian form. And this is specifically the form that it takes. Now we'll just trace over, or what's the word? Retrace our steps, not going backwards, but we'll go forward retracing our steps, but in this representation. So now we have to find again what is the reduced density matrix. So that's, of course, a reduced density matrix in a position it's now an operator. So in the position representation, it has four arguments. If we write them all out explicitly. So I've called the sort of variables x and y for the first oscillator and second oscillator, and then the sort of dual ones, x prime and y prime. And so that's equal, of course, this is just a pure state. So the density matrix, before I trace anything out, is just given by psi of x and y times psi of x prime and y prime. Star. Okay, any problem? I mean, we did it all before, so it should be familiar. But no questions on that. Okay. Then we need to find rho 1, the reduced density matrix, for the first oscillator of x. Now it's just a function of x and x prime. I put semicolon here just to carry it over from there in the previous line. That is gotten. So remember what we did before. It's the same thing here in this representation. To get the reduced density matrix for x and x prime, we set y equal to y prime, and then we integrate over all y. Okay. So it's equal to the integral over all y of rho of x and y semicolon x prime and y, the same y. And that's equal to the integral of psi of x and y times psi of x prime and the same y dy. And then that's, I won't bother to do it in detail. Here it is. Yeah, so we just have to substitute this, and then you have to do a Gaussian integral, which we've done a million times, or at least twice before, and the result is that rho 1 of x and x prime, now I'll restore the normalization, it's equal to this m over the root pi, and then the important thing, the exponent. So it's minus 1/2 m. I'm going to define these m and n in a second. And I've cast it into a form like the one we had for the many harmonic oscillators. Minus 1/4 n times x minus x prime squared, okay? So that's the where, so that's the reduced density matrix, whose entropy we know, we computed last time. So we now know the entropy of a matrix of this form, where M, in this particular case, is 1 minus mu over 1 plus mu, N is equal to 4 mu over what? 1 minus mu squared. And mu, using the same notation we used before, I've called gamma squared mu. So where the entropy is now then known in terms of gamma up here. Right? Okay. Oops. So that's the result. Something I wanted to say about it. Just the observation that, again, the way it's written, this N represents the whole effect of the interaction, or if you like, the squeezing, the fact that it's not, that it's, there's some entanglement between the two oscillators. If this term were not here, you would just have a product of two Gaussians, e to the minus 1 half m x squared and e to the minus 1 half m x prime squared. And that, of course, would have been a, that would be the signal that you were really dealing with the density matrix of a pure state, because it always takes this form of it always takes the form of just a product of the wave function with its complex conjugate. Okay, so that's the result, and the S we know, and I'll write it, it's written right above there, I'll just rewrite it in terms of mu, which was gamma squared, so it's, put the minus sign on the left, so minus S is log of 1 minus mu plus mu over 1 minus mu times log of mu. So this, so in the case, sort of we completely solved our problem in the case where we have only two oscillators. Well, almost completely solved it. So if the whenever the reduced density matrix for the one oscillator takes this form, then the entropy is given by this. Okay. We can re-express this. No. Oh, I did the. I started with the wrong black. Yeah?
I don't really understand what the difference is between x and x prime.
Oh, these are. So this row, when I write row one of x and x prime, I mean, the point is that this is a density matrix, right? So this would be like writing row ij, except that I is now a continuous variable, which is running over all values of x, and j is like running over all values of x prime. And in the Dirac, the relation to the Dirac notation is this. Okay. So this is the sandwiching of the density operator between two eigenstates of the position operator.
That's row one.
And this is row, absolutely. Yeah, this is row one of x. Okay. Other question? So let me, since I started with the wrong board, I can't have these both. So let me go over here, or maybe I can go down here a little bit. So now, this was the entropy of a general, of a specific density matrix, which is probably covered up now, namely this one. But the result is general, as is easy to see, because just by dimensional argument, if you look at this, M and M have dimensions of the same dimension, which is, if you regard x as a length, then they're just inverse length squared. But the entropy is dimensionless, so it can only depend on the ratio of M and N. So S must be some function of a dimension, the dimensionless combination of M and N, which I can take as N over M. That's a good way to do it, because M is always positive, but N could sometimes be zero, like in the case of no entanglement. So let's use N over M, so we don't have an infinity. So let me just define lambda equal to N over M, and solve for lambda in terms of mu. In fact, it's equal to 4 mu over 1 minus mu, the quantity squared. This is just simple algebra, which I won't bother to write out explicitly. Therefore, if I define lambda like this as N over M, and define mu by this equation relating it to lambda, then the entropy will necessarily be given by this expression here in terms of mu for any M and N. So this is holds, I hope the argument was clear, on dimensional grounds it holds for any M and N, and any Gaussian density matrix of this form, okay? I can also write out, so now I'll leave this here, if I can. And then just for convenience now, so we have the answer now for the arbitrary Gaussian density matrix of this form for one degree of freedom. I'll just rewrite it in slightly different variables just to make it look a little bit nicer. So we can solve for mu. See, the entropy is given in terms of mu, but lambda is the simple variable that comes from these parameters of the density matrix. So we might want to solve, to express it directly in terms of lambda, we would like to solve for mu in terms of lambda. So mu is equal to, as you can easily check, square root of 1 plus lambda minus 1 over the square root of 1 plus lambda plus 1. So mu, therefore, lambda has to be a positive number. I pointed that out last time. Here mu is gamma squared, so, and gamma squared, I guess I didn't point out, but you can see those formulas are going to become ridiculous if gamma squared is greater than 1. So we go back to the definition. This sum won't converge if gamma squared is greater than 1. You can see immediately it's bad because the normalization would become imaginary. So it only works for gamma squared less than 1. That is mu in the range 0, 1. And therefore, where is it? And then, so what I'm saying is mu has to be in the interval 0, 1. And that implies that, that implies something about lambda, not too much. Well, it implies that lambda, it leaves lambda pretty free, any positive number. But what I want to do is reintroduce a new variable, which we define to be 1 over 1 minus mu, then that in terms of lambda, it's a little bit simpler. 1 plus lambda plus 1 over 2. So this nu, as lambda goes from 0 to 1, it runs, if I put lambda 0, I'll get 1 here. And then if I make lambda arbitrarily large, then nu becomes arbitrarily large. So nu runs from 1 to infinity. Okay, so that's the range of nu. So I define nu in terms of this relationship, and lambda, remember, in terms of this relationship. So it's really just 1 plus n over m plus 1 square root, blah, 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 blah. And in terms of that, the entropy simplifies a little bit. So it becomes S of nu, which is, and that's equal to nu times log of nu minus nu minus 1 log nu minus 1. That might look, that sort of combination might look familiar to a couple of people here, and I'm sure, I may say something about that in a second. So this is the main result, where I could rewrite it out again. Nu is equal to 1 plus n over m plus 1. Okay, so this is the entropy of this oscillator, this reduced density matrix. Sorry, it's the entropy of this density matrix for the single degree of freedom. Okay? So now we know the entropy of this density matrix for single degree of freedom, and the only remaining step is to use that to get the answer for n degrees of freedom. So a remark, and this also might look familiar to people if I, we'll see you first, you might look familiar to more than the two people I had in mind for another reason, which is that this nu, you can check that that's equal to n. I mean, if we go back and trace through, or we work from this directly, you work out the expected excitation number of this harmonic oscillator, which is in this state, this thermal state, basically. Then it's really, n is nothing but the mean excitation number, the mean energy, as you might say, plus 1. So another way of writing, so this is just by the way, but you might have been familiar with this formula for a thermal density matrix, which the entropy is n plus 1 log n plus 1 minus n log n. This is really n bar, or expectation value of n, right? So that's that form. In case you've seen it before, then you can see where this result is coming from. Okay. So that also might be familiar to people. So in any case, we've now solved the one-dimensional. Oh, no, I did the same thing. Let me get this. Make sure I don't do it on the third board. When we get to it. Okay, so what do we want to say? Now we want to carry it over to n degrees of freedom. And that's really a simple step, just by diagonalizing the matrix, the two matrices that we had. So let me remind you what we had for n oscillators divided into two sets was n1 and n2 oscillators. So I think I might have actually changed just slightly the notation here. Again, I think before I might have called it Q and Q prime. I don't know, does anyone? But anyway, it means the same thing, just like we saw here. Except now each X is a whole string of X is one for each oscillator in the first set. So this is what we had found before is that the reduced density matrix for the first set, or what I was calling the Roman oscillators, because I was using a Roman index to label them, it's equal to e to the minus 1/2. You'll see it's exactly the same. I should try and have it be uncovered here. It's exactly the same expression as this, only with matrices. MAB, XA, XB, plus X prime A, X prime B, minus 1/4 NAB, X minus X prime A, X minus X prime B. Okay? So that's what we had derived a couple of times ago, I guess, or maybe we finished it last time. Anyway, we had derived this formula. And if you compare this with this, Of course, that's why I chose the notation I did here. If you compare that with this, then you see they're exactly the same, except I have M and N have just become matrices instead of just being single numbers. Now, I claim that this, because I can just say why. Remember we had this theorem, remember I gave you a list of general facts that we were going to use, like facts about the main unfamiliar one was facts about inverses of block matrices related to the blocks of the inverse and so on. But one of the facts that I gave you was that any two symmetric matrices of this form, tensors with covariant indices, if we use that language, any two quadratic forms is another language that is used sometimes for these things. But any two matrices of this form, where M is positive definite, can be simultaneously diagonalized. In other words, we can find a basis, some linear combination of the X alphas, and by replacing these X alphas by that linear combination, these will become diagonal matrices. Okay. So if that's true, then it'll just split up. This density matrix will just be a product of density matrices for just single degrees of freedom. And this M, when you diagonalize it, it'll just become, of course, not surprisingly, a diagonal matrix. But the elements on the diagonal are the eigenvalues of this M, right? Or more precise, and similarly for N. So what this means is that the entropy, therefore, by an argument that I'm not writing, but I just said in words, let me put right simultaneously diagonalize MAB and NAB. Also, I'll remind you that it's important in doing this to treat these as forms. And in other words, the location of the indices is important. Another way of saying what's going on, I'll just remind you, I think I said this before, is that N is the Hermitian matrix. You treat M as a metric, and what you're doing is finding an orthonormal basis that diagonalizes N, where the orthonormality is referred to the matrix M. It's just another, if you think about it, it's just another set of words for saying the same thing. Okay. But if you say it that way, then you know the proof, or you've seen the proof, because now it reduces to the theorem that any symmetric matrix can be diagonalized by an orthogonal transformation. You can find an orthonormal basis which makes it diagonal. And that matrix, that regarded as a linear operator, what you're actually diagonalizing is the matrix lambda AB, which is M AC times NCV. Okay. Because in that basis, M is diagonal, and it just becomes N over M. This is the inverse of M, and so it just becomes M over N. So there's different ways of seeing it, but let me pin down the notation. When I write this upstairs, MAC, I haven't separately defined it. But I mean just what I said before, use M as a metric to raise and lower. So I mean that MAB, M lower BC is delta AC. So in other words, this upstairs M is just the inverse matrix to the matrix that occurs in this expression, the downstairs M. Okay. And then I define nu exactly as before. I don't even really have to write it down again, but I will. 1 plus lambda plus 1 over 2. Lambda, of course, is the eigenvalue of this operator, this matrix lambda that I've just defined. And S of lambda And then the total entropy is just the sum. Maybe I didn't prove it, but it should be obvious. Or if not obvious, then you can... I mean, it should be physically obvious. If you have a bunch of decoupled oscillators, the entropy of the collection is just the sum of the entropies. You can also just prove it algebraically by thinking through the definitions of entropy in terms of the... I'm making it too complicated. I mean, we've made the density matrix diagonal in some way. Well, yeah, it's not... Okay, I have to say some words, but we've divided it into a product of density matrices, and you can easily check that a tensor product of density matrix has an entropy, which is a sum of the individual entropy. Just to remind you that in terms of the density matrix, the S is equal to the trace. This is just of anything, rho hat, which is really, of course, in our case, the reduced density matrix. But the entropy of any density matrix is rho hat log rho hat inverse. And so if you have a tensor product, the log converts the product to a sum, and it becomes the sum. So there's different ways of seeing it, but the main point is that it is just a sum. So it's a sum over all lambda, which are eigenvalues of this capital lambda. So as we say, lambda belongs to the spectrum, the set of eigenvalues of the capital lambda, of S of lambda, where S of lambda... I'm sure it's written somewhere else, but I can write it again here. Where S of lambda is defined to be nu log nu minus nu minus 1 log nu minus 1, with nu being this expression in terms of lambda. Okay, so that's the main result. The only thing that remains, I mean, that's the hard work. Now, that ends the hard work. The only thing that remains is to apply it to the particular density. The particular matrices M and N that we got from tracing out the one set of oscillators. I haven't told you yet. I haven't reminded you what those matrices are. So we just plug it in, and then we'll get what lambda is, and that's actually the main result. So, but this is a sort of important intermediate result. So the entropy of, we now know the entropy of any Gaussian density matrix of this form here. One comment, I think I made this comment before, but let me just say it again briefly, especially for people who aren't here. So you might wonder, I mean, we saw that these expressions only make sense, for example, when n, well, lambda is a positive number. So you might wonder if it's guaranteed that the spectrum will be positive. And the answer is that it is, because we've written here an arbitrary density matrix, but it has to be a density matrix. So what does that mean? First of all, that means it has to be normalizable. That means its trace has to be 1. Second of all, it has to be a positive operator. Does everyone know the definition of positive operator? In other words, it means that for any psi, any density matrix has to have this property. Right? Because this gets interpreted as the probability of, if you measured for a projector on psi, this is the probability that you'll find. That you'll find it is in the state psi. Anyway, so in order for that, that has to be a number between 0 and 1. So in particular, it has to be positive. And then the total probability has to be 1. So that's the statement that the trace of rho hat has to be 1. So in order for this to be, if you just look at it, in order for the trace to, what does it mean that the trace is 1 in terms of this formula? Well, what is the trace? The trace of rho hat, it's just a normalization condition. But the important thing is that the trace of rho hat should be finite. It's not finite. We can't possibly normalize it. And what is the trace of rho hat? That's just the integral of x rho x dx, which is equal to, this is a kind of shorthand, which is equal to the integral of rho of xx dx. Right? This is, these are actually multidimensional integrals. We used this before, basically, when we traced out the second oscillators. So to take the trace, you set the two arguments of the density matrix equal, and then you integrate over all values of that argument. So if we wanted to take the trace, let's look and see if we wanted to take what it would mean or what we would need in order that the trace be normalizable, that it be finite. So in this case, that means we set x equals x prime. We want x equals x prime and integrate dx. Well, if we set x equals x prime, that second term goes away, and we're left with an integral of e to the minus mab xa xb dx. Okay. Just an ordinary Gaussian integral. And you know whether or not, you know what it takes for this to be finite. This m must have no zero modes, no flat directions, and it certainly must not have any negative direction. So it has to look like this, right, and not like this or like this. So what that means is that M must be a positive definite matrix. So this formula, which is completely general, is not so general that it's nonsense, which means that we must regard M as a positive definite matrix. And then I'm not going to go through the argument for N. It'll be, for this, it's enough. I mean, the positive definiteness of M suffices to make the trace finite. But we also need that we need this property, the positivity of the operator rho hat. And that turns out to make N be a positive semi-definite matrix. So as we derived last time that is, in fact, true for the particular M and N that I'm about to write down that came out of tracing out the second set of oscillators. But in this general thing, we must assume that the matrix M is greater than zero, what's called positive definite, and that the matrix N is greater than or equal to zero as it's written, which means positive semi-definite, as it's called, which means that when you diagonalize it, you don't get any negative diagonal elements, but you could get some zeros. And I think, as I pointed out last time, if the two sets of oscillators had been decoupled, then N would actually be zero. So you can't, it's not necessarily positive definite. That's enough, obviously, to make this lambda operator finite. Well-defined and with positive eigenvalues. Because it's just N over N. It's just a diagonal matrix now, which is N over M for each diagonal element. That's zero, possibly, but otherwise a strictly positive number. Okay? So any questions on this general? Now we're just about to apply it to the Now we want to. Now all we have to do is apply it. So I have to remind you what the rho reduced was. The rho reduced was. Better go to the other. No, I have it here. So this was the rho reduced for the first set of oscillators. Except I haven't reminded you what M and N were. So remember, M was equal to W tilde AB. So remember what this, since it was a while ago, I'll probably bring it back on the board. We had two sets of oscillators, and then there were the A oscillators and the alpha, AB and alpha beta, as I used the indices, oscillators. We had the whole thing in its ground state. The whole thing had a potential energy matrix I used capital AB for the full set of oscillators, little a for the one set and little alpha for the other set. And this was the potential energy, and then there was a kinetic energy given by this matrix, GAB, that was the kinetic energy thing. And we used, and then W, I won't rehearse its whole definition, but use, it's just, if we think of this as a metric, then W was the square root of V. It was the square root matrix. Okay. So that's what W was. And then W little b would have just been the matrix, the block matrix that belongs to the first oscillators. But what I call W tilde little a little b was the inverse of the block submatrix of the inverse of the whole W that belongs to the Roman oscillators, right? So that was W tilde AB. And NAB was somewhat messier expression. It was WA alpha, W tilde alpha beta, W beta B, where this tilde thing is defined quite analogously. In other words, this is now for the Greek. That's the ones we traced out for the Greek oscillators. But it's equal, this is now the inverse of the Greek block of the original matrix W. Okay, that's the notation I've adopted. What does this mean? But in our expression for lambda, we had upstairs, we had M somewhere. There we had this inverse of the matrix M. Now M pertains only to the Roman oscillators, so it's the inverse of that. So we have to invert this, but I just told you that this was the inverse of the AB, the Roman block of the inverse of W. So that's what that. First, we can translate. What I'm doing now is translating everything back into W, and so which was the fundamental quantity.
I'm sorry. What's it tilde W?
So tilde W. It's defined by the. If you like, it's defined by this equation. W tilde. Which one do you want to look? This one, AB. Times WBC is delta AC. Now that's different from saying, see, that is confusingly similar looking to the following equation, which is also true, WA capital B. So now it's running over both. Capital B is equal to delta CA. Right. So the difference between these two is in this I'm summing over all the oscillators, and in this I'm summing over only the Roman oscillators. So it's the inverse. So to get this WBC, we invert the full WAB, and then we take the Roman submatrix of it. That's what this WBC means. And then we invert that again, and that gives us W tilde AB. It's a little tricky, but.
And W tilde still runs over both Roman and.
No.
And Greek.
No, it runs only over Greek.
Because there's another.
There's another one which runs only over Roman. So there's. Actually, you weren't. I think you weren't here for. Were you for the first lecture? I don't think you were. So, yeah, I described that stuff, and then I suggested people as a homework to prove it to themselves, because the only way you, I think, can overcome the confusion is to go through the algebra. But there's like four of these or something, right? I mean, there's the Roman upstairs, the Roman downstairs, the Greek upstairs, and the Greek downstairs. And they are all related to the untilded ones by the same basic principle that you take a subblock of some whatever the relevant matrix is, you invert it, and that gives you the tilde 1, okay. So this is. So now we just have to remember what some of the other general facts from the first time. So now that I know what M and N are, I can find what is lambda. Lambda CB. Look back to what we have up here. Somewhere. Here we have this. I put C instead of A. So it's lambda, it's MCA. And AB, right? It's just, see this, yeah, okay. So it's just that combination. This is the Roman block of the inverse of the matrix. Oh, sorry, I haven't yet plugged in what this was. So MAB, we just saw that was W, I reminded you, you have to go back and compare with what we found before, but we saw that was W tilde. What am I doing here? C. Something I've written wrong. It's not what I have. That this was MCA. It's this thing. That was equal to WCA. That's what I should have written. And then NAB, and NAB, that was WA alpha, W tilde alpha beta, W beta B, I think is the, did I get it right? I think those are the CB, these are the free indices. Yes, okay. So I've just plugged in what these two things were. But now we have to use one other thing, which is this trick or this identity. If you remember from the first time, this thing, see, this is a C, a Roman, and then a Greek. And I've summed only over the Romans. I can sum over only the Greeks instead, but I have to put a minus sign by that. So this, I had told you before that this was minus W. C alpha W, oops, C gamma, let me call it, W gamma alpha. So it's equal to minus W C gamma W gamma alpha W tilde alpha beta W beta gamma. But now we go back to the definition of the W tilde, by definition, these and this and this are inverse matrices when we sum over only the Greek indices. So this is equal to just delta gamma beta. So then it becomes minus W C beta W beta gamma. C beta W. This is gamma beta, so.
The last gamma.
I guess that's, and this is a B. What have I done here? Yeah, this is, that's right. There's supposed to be a B here. Oh, I see. This is supposed to be a B.
I think it's beta, not beta gamma.
Right, beta B, that's it. Okay, good. So minus C gamma, if you like, and then W gamma B. So that's the final one or two final expressions for lambda. So lambda A B. Lambda AB, just changing the notation, is minus W A gamma, let's say, W gamma B. So this is a sort of put two boxes, because this is somehow the main result. So you start with V, you start with the potential energy, you take its square root, and that way that gives you W. And then you write down something that if I had summed this over all Roman and Greek indices, would have been the identity. But I sum it over only the Greek indices. So it's like if I go back, you know, if I go back to that picture, I have the two sets of oscillators. I have A here, and I had gamma here, and then I'm coming back to B. But so I'm summing only over those. So one sees immediately that there would be zero entropy. You see, the only contribution, and then, of course, you get the eigenvalues of lambda, and you plug in to that formula that we had there. So it's a sum over the eigenvalues of lambda. We could write this as an operator equation for lambda, but I don't think it adds anything. So basically, just think of diagonalizing this lambda and then plugging into that formula and doing a sum over all the eigenvalues. That's the entropy. One thing that you see immediately is that this would be zero if, I mean, it's only the off-diagonal that is Greek to Roman matrix elements of W that figure here. If there were no coupling between these and these, then you would take, as we discussed last time, when you took the square root of V, you would just get two block V. If there were no coupling at all, V itself would be a block matrix like this. And then, therefore, the square root of V would also be a block matrix like this. And these off-diagonal things would all be zero. And so you would, this would be the off-diagonal block of the inverse of W, and this would be the off-diagonal block of W. They'd both be zero, and lambda would be zero. So it's consistent in the sense we see that it shows in a very clear way how it is precisely the entanglement between these oscillators and these oscillators due to the coupling between them that gives rise to the entropy. Now, I just want to, was there a question? So I just want to give a couple more formulas. First, here's another form that follows immediately, WAB, lambda AB. We said, so the interest of this is that shows that it shows clearly that the coupling between the two sets of oscillators is what produces the entanglement entropy. However, it's also interesting, and it's kind of become well known now, that if you think about it, it's sort of clear that you should be able to express the entropy entirely in terms of, I mean, in the end, all we care is the reduced density matrix for these set of oscillators. Because it's a Gaussian state, if we know the correlators between these oscillators, we actually know fully the ground state. So it must be possible to express the entropy in terms of quantities only pertaining to the A oscillators. And that we can do easily just by extending this sum. So it's, let me add and subtract. See, let me put minus WA gamma, W gamma beta, B, sorry. But let me also put minus A, let's say D, WD, some other Roman B, right? And then add it back in. But by doing this, I've extended the sum to be over all the indices. So this is really minus WA, what shall I call it? Capital, I want something that's clearly a capital index. So to say AE WEB, which is just equal to minus delta AB. So we can also write lambda AB as equal to this thing, WA, E was a nice letter, I'll let it be E. WAE times WEB minus delta AB. That's another in sort of instructive way to write the answer. Here you see it involves only things involving the Roman indices. There's no more reference to the Greek indices. That doesn't quite do what I said, because, I mean, this notationally, there's no more reference to the Greek indices, but you might feel that when I, in order to produce these things, I needed to look at the Greek indices, look at the Greek oscillators, which indeed I did. But I won't bother to do it, but I think I mentioned last time or the time before that these things, if we now introduce the Q and P operators for the Roman oscillators, these W's are directly related to the correlators of the Q and the P. In other words, they're directly related to things like Q hat A, Q hat B, and so on for the A, for the Roman oscillators. So in fact, this has the effect of, if you like, you can use this to write the answer totally in terms of correlators involving only the A and B oscillators. And that will be, so this involves only correlators on the Roman oscillators. Or what you might call the retained oscillators, the ones that we didn't trace out. That's, some of you will be familiar to anyway, will be familiar with some a formula like this that involves the Whiteman function for field theory and so on. And a nice homework problem that I would suggest at the end is to use that to make the connection between this formulas that we have, I mean, to use these observations here to explicitly make the connection between that other formula, which is also in some other paper. It's in papers by Abhishek Dhar in a condensed matter setting. Anyway, the main thing is that there are two very general kinds of formulas for entanglement entropy between two sets of oscillators. And it would be nice to have a completely explicit relationship between the two sets, the two formulas. In the field theory, it becomes things like phi of x, phi of y for a scalar field. Anyway, this remarks might be a little bit obscure for those who are not familiar with it already. And then I wanted to mention one other thing. So I think from the point of view of insight in physics, these are the most important formulas. There's also, however, from a computational point of view, it might be worth to go back to where this came from. It came from, remember, the lambda came from simultaneously diagonalizing M and N. So M is really this W tilde, and N is this more complicated combination. So we could say what we've done is diagonalize N AB, which is equal to WA alpha, W tilde alpha, beta W beta B, relative to, using M as a metric, which was W tilde alpha, beta, well, M, using MAB equals W tilde AB as metric. Remember when I discussed that? This has two advantages. I mean, noticing that's two advantages. First, it shows us that lambda can be diagonalized. See, if I just give you the final answer and say this is lambda, you might say, if you're like mathematical pathologies or something, if you like to be not troublesome and whatsoever, if you like to be perverse, then you might say, well, how do you know that this matrix can be diagonalized? Not every matrix can be diagonalized. One can write down, everyone seen matrices that cannot be diagonalized? Sort of. Here's one. The simplest one is just the annihilation operator for fermions. 0, 1, 0, 0. You can't diagonalize this matrix. So you might say, how do you know it can be diagonalized? Well, the one way that we know is go back to where it came from. This is simultaneous diagonalization of two symmetric quadratic forms, and that we know can always be done. But there's also a computational, by using this as metric, if you like, I'm just meaning we use it to raise the index on the n to get lambda, which was here, right? So it's hard to say these things because people in general don't pay attention to the distinction between covariant indices and mixed indices and contravariant indices. But to say it carefully, you need to do that. So on one hand, it shows us that lambda is diagonalizable. But on the other hand, which of course followed from the whole derivation, but that's how it follows really from the derivation. But on the other hand, it may be computationally simpler because if we have to, in order to get these things, what do we need? We need, so if you wanted to put this in a computer and do the minimal amount of number crunching, namely inverting large matrices, like if you had many oscillators, right, then it may be convenient to use this because we have, you see this W tilde alpha beta, that's only the diagonalized, it's only inverting the block, the Greek block of the matrix. We also needed this W tilde AB, but that, by another formula that I gave you before, is WAB minus W A alpha W tilde alpha beta W beta B. Well, you do have to do a couple of, you can't get away from these matrix multiplications, I think. But again, we only need to invert the block. Whereas if we just looked at this straight out, we would say, well, this is the Greek mixed off-diagonal block of the inverse of the whole matrix W. Is it? You'd have to invert the whole matrix. So there may be some small computational advantage to, inversion is kind of n cubed. So if you save a factor of 2 in the size of the matrix, it's almost 10 times faster. So anyway, that's a less important, except for practical purposes. But there may be some advantage in looking at it like that too. Okay, and there's a few. I could put it in several other slightly different forms, which would all be true and would all be illuminating if you took the time to think what they meant, but would, I think, be more confusing if I just write them carefully, I mean, quickly. So I won't bother with those. So that's the main result, and let me just summarize it quickly, and then we'll go on to, in whatever time remains, we'll go on to talk about the area law and the need for a cutoff. So here's the summary of everything that we've done so far. We had two sets of oscillators, A and alpha oscillators, in the global ground state. We took the, when I say the ground state, we took the Hamilton, I won't bother with all the indices here. We took the Lagrangian to be this. But it's important, of course, that this is now for all the oscillators. We define W then to be the square root of V relative to G. I won't repeat what all those things mean. I think I've said them two or three times. We define lambda to be, now it's lambda AB, minus W A gamma W gamma B. For maximum clarity, I should put the indices here. So these are the capital these things together here are capital indices. Okay. WAB is just the inverse of WAB downstairs. Then we diagonalized this lambda. So this little lambda, the eigenvalue, is in the spectrum of lambda AB. Its range is basically any positive number. We define nu as equal to, what was it again? Lambda plus 1, square root plus 1 over 2. And then S was the sum over all lambdas, or over all nus, now of nu log nu minus 1. So this is everything we've done so far. And it will give you, I won't rewrite, I could also write the other expression for lambda, which is right up there in the box. Okay, so that's a natural place to pause if there are any questions on what we've done so far.
I'd just like to check that, so the W's are block diagonal?
No, not at all.
No.
Not at all, no. If they were, then we would get zero entropy. That would mean that in the original, if the W had been block diagonal, then because V is W squared, that would mean that V would also be block diagonal. And that would be saying that there's no potential energy term coupling the oscillators in the one set to the oscillators in the other set. Yeah.
Why did we expect to be able to write lambda in terms of the Roman oscillators only?
That's because I used some things that are maybe not obvious until they're unless they're obvious. You know, that is, they're not obvious until they become very familiar, and then they become. So.
I guess that's because, in general, because you are Gaussian model, so the correlation matrix is basically determined by the density matrix. There are some relation between them. So.
That's right. You mean, but it's the converse of what you said. The density matrix is determined by the correlation matrix. So when you have. So let's go back. It's generally assumed in physics, although, again, if you want to be mathematically, if you want to be a perverse mathematician, there are counterexamples to these kind of things. But it's generally assumed that if we know all the correlators, all the endpoint functions, as one says, that we would totally know the density matrix for any system. Right? Now, as you just said, since that's true, or let's not be perverse and suppose that it's true. It's in quantum field theory, it's always assumed in one way or another that you just work with the endpoint functions. You don't bother to have to write down some huge density matrix or pure state, usually for the vacuum. So let's assume that it's true. Then it means that if we know all the correlators, all the endpoint functions, not just 2, but 3, 4, 5, 6. If we know that for the Q, all the operators pertaining to the first set of oscillators, which would be the Qs, but it would also be the Qs and the Ps and the Ps and the Ps. And as I said, in the field theory, that's all sort of captured by a single thing called the Whiteman function, which are the correlators. But if we knew this is, Whiteman functions, I suppose, is more general, where you can put any number of factors here. If you knew all of those for any number of factors, then you would have to know the state fully. So you would have to know the density matrix fully. So it has to be possible, in principle, from knowing all those endpoint functions to know the entropy, because once you know the density matrix, you can compute the entropy. However, that would if that's all there was to it, we'd need to also work out the three-point functions, the four-point functions, all the higher correlators. But now comes the fact that you said, because it's a Gaussian state, Gaussian density matrix, it turns out that all the endpoint correlators are given by what's called Wick's rule in terms of the two-point correlators. You might have run across this in another context if you're interested in cosmology. People are interested, for example, in the primordial density fluctuations. Are they Gaussian or are they not? Most theories, although not all scenarios, but the most straightforward ones tend to produce Gaussian correlations. How would you test for that? So one way of testing for whether it's Gaussian or not is to look at the three-point function, in that case, it's the correlators of the CMB's temperature on the sky. For a Gaussian state, at least if the expectation value is of the, if the one-point function is zero, then the three-point function will also be zero. And it is zero for us here. So the three-point function would vanish, and then that's a test for Gaussian, but also the four-point function has to be given in terms of the two-point function just in terms of sums of products of two-point function. So all of those things are true. So all the higher correlators follow just from the two-point correlators. So since we have a Gaussian state, the entropy must follow just from the two-point correlators. But what's remarkable is that there's such a simple formula that does it. I haven't given you the full formula because I haven't fully related this to the W's, but you can if you go back to the formulas we had for the ground state in the beginning. You should find it not too hard to relate these. Okay? So that's one thing to always be aware of. Gaussian, kind of the practical meaning, the mathematical meaning is an exponential curve, but the practical meaning in a lot of physics is just that the endpoint functions are reduced to the two-point functions using this Wick rule, so-called Wick rule. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I wanted to start with... What I wanted to do is, I think we're running a little short on time, but we'll see next time what is the best thing to do. One possibility would be to have another half lecture or another lecture, depending on interest. But let's forge ahead and see how far we can get. So what I was intending to do, finish today, was to give the heuristic derivation of the area law. So the next half of the, there's kind of three, I suppose there's really three segments to this course. The first one we've just completed, which is this general derivation for a finite dimensional case, finite number of coupled oscillators. The second one is heuristic derivation of the area law and the need for a cutoff. And then the third one is the application of this formalism to field theory and write down a sort of integral equation that needs to be, that has never been fully solved. It led to the area law, but the actual diagonalization has never been completed. So I think there's a nice mathematical physics problem there, which is what I want to end with. So we can get it. So the next section, so this two out of three now, the next section is, if it had a title, it would be something like the need for a cutoff and the area law. So you can't have the area law without a cutoff because if you don't have a finite entropy, then it's meaningless to talk how it scales with anything. Okay. Just say area law. let me give just a little discussion on the cutoff, and then we'll quit for today. So why do we need a cutoff at all? Now we're talking about field theory. Of course, we could be talking about some condensed matter system or some hypothetical condensed matter system, like a Bunsen spin system or something, or a real one made of atoms and so on, or something that was cooked up cleverly in a lab to resemble one of the other two. In that case, of course, there's always really a cutoff, because there's always, when you get down to the atomic level, the description in terms of continuum field no longer makes sense. And it might or might not look like a bunch of coupled harmonic oscillators, but in any case, there will be some sort of cutoff. That is, if we work in terms of the language of a field theory, there'll be some shortest wavelength of the field that makes sense. So I claim that if we don't have that, as I mentioned before, let me say one other thing, as I mentioned before, that's fine for laboratory physics of ordinary materials, material science, but it's not good for field Lorentz invariant field theories. That kind of cutoff is not good because it's not Lorentz invariant. And that's a deep problem of how to make sense of quantum field theory. But let me just now say, give a heuristic. So what I'm claiming when I say we need a cutoff, what I mean is that if you do this analogous manipulations that we've just done in field theory, and these would, what we've just done here was based on coupled harmonic oscillators, just quadratic couplings. In other words, it would, in the case of field theory, that corresponds to a free, what's called a free field, no higher order, higher degree terms in the Lagrangian. If we were to do that, I claim, and not put a cutoff, and we take the two sets of oscillators to be given, of course, when we say field theory, we're thinking of the value of each phi of x at some point in a region of space is analogous to what I was calling q sub a or something like that. Probably headed upstairs. Qa, where, you know, so it's like an infinity of harmonic oscillators all coupled to their neighbors. That's standard or familiar way of thinking about a quantum field theory. So at least a free field theory. So I'm claiming that if we divide the oscillators in that way into the ones on the left of some partition or the right of some partition, and that's our set one and our set two, and then we go and compute the entropy, we'll get an infinite answer. So why do we expect to get an infinite answer? So that's you might just say, well, there's an infinite number of oscillators. I'm not all that surprised we got an infinite answer. But you can make a stronger case than just that. So let's start, remind you what I mean by the Lagrangian of a free scalar field. Now, most of what we're going to do, we're going to be taking the mass, just for simplicity, to be zero. But in the following argument, it's going to be important that I consider a range of masses, not just zero mass. And I'll remind you, when I say grad phi squared, of course, that's a shorthand for 8 mu nu grad mu phi, grad mu phi, right? Just the usual. And I've also, if you like, set c to 1, the speed of light, and also, more importantly, h bar to be equal to 1, so that I can regard m as a length, the mass as a length. Now, consider let's consider not this particular way of dividing up. Let's consider it slightly different. So I'll consider space at a moment of time, so I'll consider just t equals 0. And then there'll be some effective vacuum state defined at that moment of time. And I'll divide space into I'll take a big sphere of radius r, and I'll divide space into the region inside and the region outside. Actually, for my own purpose, just to make myself happy, I'll let one be the region outside, because I'm thinking this might be a black hole, of course. So we're more interested. But it doesn't matter, as we saw before, you get the same entanglement entropy, whichever one you call one or two. Okay, so now, what can the entanglement... the only thing that can influence the entanglement entropy is the geometry of these two regions and the mass of the field. So the geometry is fully specified by, because it's a sphere, by a single number r. And of course, the mass can also enter. But the same as before, remember that s has to be a dimensionless quantity. So it can only depend on a dimensionless combination of those two. So what's the dimensionless combination? Well, remember m. Once we set C and H bar to 1, as convenient to do in quantum field theory, then M is just an inverse length. It's basically just the Compton wavelength of the particle that's described by this field. So it must be, so the dimensionless combination is M times R. So the entropy, were it to be finite, this is like, you know, this is a proof by contradiction. So if the entropy were to be finite, it would be some finite function of the product M times R. But now, what's going to happen? Now let R go, let's hold M fixed, and let R go to 0. What does that mean? That means the sphere is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. In the limit, there's nothing to be entangled. When nothing is left to be entangled, then, as we saw, and is obvious anyway, the entanglement entropy has to be 0. So assuming this to be a finite function, that means that means f of x, it's called the argument, goes to 0 as x goes to 0, as the argument goes to 0. But now let's consider another thing. Let the size of the sphere go to 0 at fixed mass, fixing the theory. Let's change the theory, hold R fixed, and let M go to 0. Okay, so now we're considering a fixed sphere, but a succession of different theories in which the mass is going to 0. Well, but since all that matters is the product of M times R, it doesn't matter which one we let to go to 0. So if we let M to go to 0 with R fixed, it implies MR goes to 0. But we just saw, which is I called here X. So the argument of F goes to 0, so it implies that F of MR goes to 0. And that's, i.e., the entropy goes to 0. So if it were finite, it would mean that if we let the mass go to 0, the entanglement entropy would go away. But that's ridiculous. And you can only, the only thing that the mass does is it sort of cuts off correlations at large distances. But entanglement comes precisely from such correlations. So if you make the mass smaller and smaller, you would expect that the entanglement would just go up and certainly not go down. And it's ridiculous to imagine, it's absurd to imagine that a massless field or any field has no correlation across this boundary. We know for sure, because now if you know enough about the structure of the vacuum in a free theory, it entails correlation. That's, if you like, it's this Whiteman function, this phi phi, is not zero. It's even at space-like separations. There are correlations. So it can't be right. So the only way out of that is that the entropy was infinite, right? Because then, okay, it's getting to be a smaller and smaller infinity, but it's still infinite. So that, I mean, in other words, the argument doesn't really make sense when the entropy. is infinite. So that's, as I think I said in words, and I'll write it down here. This is a heuristic argument. It's not a proof of anything, but it's a very strong indication that the entanglement will be, entropy will be infinite in the case of a massive field theory. And in the limit, then, in the case of a massless field theory. So if entanglement entropy is to be finite in reality, nature must be providing a cutoff. And we don't know what's providing it. Presumably, the best guess is it's something to do with quantum field theory, and it's quantum gravity, sorry, and that it should be Lorentz invariant for the case of a Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. Doesn't need, but what else? Make another suggestion.
Do we understand quantum field theory well enough?
It might well be that quantum field theory, when it's well understood, does require some sort of cutoff. I mean, there are proposed counterexamples, but they're not very realistic. I mean, the standard model, as we know it, does appear to actually require a cutoff. So it's possible that even at the level of quantum field theory, in order to consistently define it, it requires a cutoff. But then you'd want to know what's the physical origin of that cutoff. And the only candidate I know for something like that is a causal set. You could try and do the quantum field theory on a fixed causal set, and you would have, at large distances, you would have still preserved Lorentz invariance, and at small distances, you would have a cutoff of a Lorentz invariant nature. But if you were only thinking of quantum field theory and nothing else, you would say, well, this is just an ad hoc, well, you just invented some cutoff. But we don't understand what is it, you know, in the case of condensed matter, we know the physical meaning as a cutoff. It's the atomic nature of materials. But we don't know in quantum field theory what that cutoff is. So I guess when I say quantum gravity, I mean, what's going to explain the origin of the cutoff? You're right. You could, from a logical point of view, and say, well, this is now what I mean by a quantum field theory. I've just changed my definition a little bit, and this is what it is. But it would be more satisfying if we could give the physical basis of this new element that got introduced into the quantum field theory. Free field theories in themselves don't need cutoffs, of course. But if we believe that the entanglement entropy should be finite, then we do need a cutoff. And that's another reason to see a connection with quantum gravity, because the strongest argument for the finiteness of entanglement entropy in nature is the finiteness of black hole entropy. And that specifically has to do with quantum gravity. So anyway, what we have learned in this so far, that's more far afield, but what we've learned here is that we will need a cutoff. And so now, the next time I wanted to argue more quantitatively how we should expect, so now that we have the cutoff, the entropy will be, it'll now be some function if there's a mass of the radius of the sphere, if we happen to use a sphere. And the new thing, right, the cutoff. There's another length in the story now, which is the cutoff. And since we have this other length, and I've introduced the m here only for purposes of this argument, it's important to understand it, but the simplest case to study is where m equals 0. And now this, so that's the one we'll be studying. And then now we can make, let me put it the other way. Let's say, no, this way. It can look like the ratio, it can depend now on the ratio of R over L. And so the next question is, well, what's the nature of that dependence? And the area law is the statement that it scales like R squared, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, scales like R squared over L squared. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, just like R over L. And in 1 plus 1 dimension, just like, if you strictly believed in area law, it would just be R over L to the zero. But things like x to the zero often turn out to be logs, and that's what we'll see happens in 1 plus 1 dimension. So it'll depend on a log of R over L again, by a heuristic argument. Then we'll start to set up. To make those heuristic arguments completely rigorous, you need to go and do a calculation in field theory, and that's in the last part. I'll set up that calculation and propose it to you all as a nice research problem to work on.
How do we know the power law dependence you just said?
We don't know. I'm saying I'm going to give next time a heuristic argument for what it should be, and that heuristic argument will lead to what I just said. And people call it an area law because it means, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, it means that the entanglement entropy is proportional. R squared over L squared is the area in units of the cutoff, right? And in 2 plus 1, it's really a length, but that's the perimeter, so it's like area, you know, in a lower dimension.
So is the power law behavior you said is also a free theory
model? Everything I'm saying henceforth, and I think up till now also, all depended on having it be a free theory, right? Although this result is proven or derived, let me say, maybe not rigorous, I'm not, but anyway, it's derived in conformal field theories and 1 plus 1, so it has a more general, a free theory is a special case of a conformal theory, but it has a more general application in that case. And there are some other, anyway. But everything I'm saying is free.
Sorry, so I think I missed part of the argument. You introduce a cutoff so that the entropy is no longer infinity, but then the cutoff is near the boundary of the region. So that.
Well, I haven't told you how we're going to, I haven't yet introduced the cutoff. So what I'll say next time will sort of give a sense of what the cutoff. I mean, the intuitive way I think about it is, the theory that we've just studied has a finite entropy. Suppose you think of a field as a continuum of harmonic oscillators. One way of thinking of a cutoff. It's not Lorentz invariant, that's the complaint I'm always making, but and it's make the same complaint against the model that we'll show at the end. But one way of thinking of a cutoff is to have a finite but large density of harmonic oscillators rather than an infinite density of harmonic oscillators. And so that's the most natural way. So Yasman did some calculation with a one-dimensional case using exactly that cutoff. In the case of the when we get to the field theory, I'll write down an integral equation. This lambda will be an integral operator. And the natural way to put the cutoff in that case is to run the integral instead of from 0 to infinity, just to epsilon to infinity or little l to infinity. So, but the physical meaning is always something like there should not be an infinite number of oscillators arbitrarily close to the boundary all entangled with oscillators on the other side of the boundary that are arbitrarily close to it. That's what brings the infinity. And so if you want to make it finite, you have to damp those out one way or another. So then you can try and think of different ways. You could just damp out the interactions, but you'd have to do, the simplest way is just to say that there's a finite density of oscillators. But the way to do it, fully Lorentz invariant, we still don't know. We're working on it for the using the causal set as a cutoff, as a kind of space-time cutoff. It can't be regarded as a cutoff in space at a moment of time. That would immediately break the Lorentz symmetry. But the causal set is a kind of space-time cutoff, and it is Lorentz invariant in a very strong sense.
You're trying to do this calculation for causal sets in what dimension?
We'd love to do it at the moment 1 plus 1. Because the computer, the number of lattice, the number of elements of the causal set grows rapidly with dimension. But of course, ideally 3 plus 1. Because it's a lot easier to see. It's a trade-off, right? An area law is a lot easier to see, a linear relation is a lot easier to see than a log. in 1 plus 1, you expect a log, but log numerically is very difficult to see. But 1 plus 1 is nice because there's only a few causal set elements, relatively speaking, needed to fill up the space-time. So
do you have a finite number of oscillators there?
Well, we don't have oscillators at all, so it's a little more subtle. So you need to go... So I referred a few times to this relation in between the Whiteman function, that is the space-time correlator. The Whiteman function is actually a space-time correlator. What I actually wrote here, if it's still around, might not be. What I wrote here involved just Heisenberg operators, let's say, at a moment of time, but you don't have those in the causal set. It doesn't have a slicing because it's discrete both in space and in time. So, but what you do have is the space-time analog of it, which is this. So correlators between scalar fields at different elements of the causal set. And using this kind of derivation, you can generalize these formulas, and you get actually an extremely simple, similar formula. Only the names were changed. I think nu became lambda or some. There was some notational inconsistency between the two formulas, but you get a very similar formula that no longer requires W to be the analog of W. I mean, it allows zero modes, and in a quantum field theory, you have zero modes galore, actually, of the Whiteman function. I mean, we could discuss it. I'll be happy to discuss it even afterwards, but we shouldn't keep everyone to. But that's the idea, to use the analog of this. There's a space, a more four-dimensional or two or n plus one-dimensional version instead of purely spatial version of these entropy formulas. And the idea is to use those on the causal set where you can make sense of them. Other questions, comments?